Okay, we are live in the Gugino Baseball Clubhouse at 67 East 11th Street in the landmark cast iron building, Greenwich Village, City of New York. We'll start tonight as we always do. For those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. For those of you who have been here before, welcome home. Tonight is our pleasure to welcome Jim Gulo, the author of Trading Manny, How a Father and Son Learned to Love Baseball Again, published by DiCapo. And it is really a terrific book.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming and for writing this book.
Yeah, my pleasure. And thanks for having me. Actually, this was the first booking that we got to do an appearance to talk about the book just before it came out. And I was just thrilled that you called back then and said, yeah, so give us a great excuse to come to New York and talk about the book a little bit.
Well, when I first saw the synopsis, my former intern, one of his jobs was to look up all the new books coming out in 2012. And as soon as I saw the synopsis, I said, this one is going on the calendar.
Yeah. And well, who was I up against? You know, R.A. Dickey and Yogi Berra. These are my competition this year.
Yeah, well, some of them have been here and some won't, but that's okay.
I say in the book that I got warning track power. You know, I can't throw a ball 90 miles an hour. At my best, I could maybe touch 80 back in the day. And I have to, if I hit a long ball, I have to stop at third and catch my breath. So I'm not the typical baseball writer here, but I had a different story to tell.
Yeah, well, we know you're not on steroids, at least that way.
Yeah. That's a pretty good thing. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Do you know what you're saying?
Well, how do you think I got this headed?
So I think maybe the best way to start is, since our the true honored guest here tonight is Joe, is in the audience.
Yeah.
Who's no longer seven. I think he's about to have his 12th birthday.
Yeah.
But that was a pleasant surprise for me that Joe showed up today. So thank you, Joe, for coming.
Sure.
And I think maybe the best way to start would be as you started the book. If you could take us back to that moment in December 2007,
mm-hmm.
when you and Joe had a...
Well, if we go back 6 months before that, Joe's seventh birthday is in June of 2007. And amongst all the other gifts that a kid gets, he gets a baseball video game in a stack of other video games, and he gets a few baseball cards. And all of a sudden, Joe goes nuts over baseball. He starts playing the video game just night and day, religiously, and it used real major league players' likenesses, of course. And so he would come to the breakfast table the next day and say, "Travis Hafner is a really good hitter, but he's got a really small head," and stuff like that. And he starts memorizing all of the statistics and all the on the back of baseball cards, and it was great. I had this little kid who was suddenly crazy about baseball, right? And it lasted. But December 2007 rolls around, and out comes the Mitchell Report. And I didn't even tell Joe about it. He's a little kid, you know. He's 7 years old. But I'm sitting here reading about all these baseball players, 89 players named in the Mitchell Report as having been linked to drug use, steroids, or human growth hormone. And I'm kind of gasping, you know. Oh, my goodness. I never dreamt that it was that pervasive, right? And Joe hears about it, and he goes to the paper and starts reading about it and watches it on ESPN. And his first response that very night was, he starts separating this baseball card collection. Was David Bell named in the Mitchell Report? Yeah. She transfers his card over to another binder of juicers. You know, was Wally Joyner? Yeah. How about Move On? You know, and so it was very clear to this little kid that it was wrong, first of all, and that a real line had been crossed, you know, in baseball. And he wanted to make sure that the clean players, as it were not even in the same binder of baseball players as the juicers. And that's what started it. You know, I thought at that time, well, this is interesting, you know, and this is kind of crazy. And this is going to pass over. He's a little kid. But over the course of the next few months, just out of the blue, Joe would just suddenly enter his mind and he'd want to talk about it. One time we're in the airport in Calgary. We're coming back from a ski trip. And we haven't talked about baseball for 2 weeks. And we're standing there in line, and he turns to me and he said, "Barry Bonds is awful. He shouldn't be allowed to play anymore. His, you know, why is his record still standing?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean? He's aging. He's towards the end of his career." "No, he took steroids. It's clear he took steroids." And I said, "You know, the first time that I had this this response was like, well, you know, he says he didn't know he took steroids, or we're not sure he took steroids. It's alleged. You know, we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt." And Joe just looks at me and goes, "Oh, come on, Dad. You know? I mean, come on. Is there any doubt, you know, that Barry Bonds used something to get that big and strong?" And he said, "And why is this record still standing? Hank Aaron's still the home run king as far as I'm concerned." And I thought again, you know, the kid's right. You know, he really is. And nobody in baseball was really talking about this. We were all kind of outraged, you know, from the owners, the commissioner, the general managers, Lou Piniella and Tony La Russa, anybody in the game, to fans like me, casual fans. We kind of took it in stride or just said, what a shame. But for this little kid, it was like, well, something's got to be done about this, doesn't it? You know, don't we have to know who did them? Which records are safe? Are these guys going to get disciplined at all? Is it going to keep going happening? And so I realized, well, geez, you know, something important is happening here, and I got to pay attention to it. So I started writing down. A lot of this book is just transcriptions of conversations we had over the next 12 months about, you know, about baseball and drug use and records and how it all wove together in this whole history of baseball that we all love, you know. How can you compare? How can you compare Bonds now with any of the great sluggers, you know, without having to do this whole kind of fantasy thing about, well, if he hadn't taken drugs, or if he only took drugs from 2002 to 2006, maybe he would have hit 550, all of that stuff. And for a little 8-year-old kid, it was very clear, number one, it was wrong. Number two, what would happen if I did them? Well, you'd be grounded for the rest of your life, you know, is the first answer. But, you know, I didn't really know. So part of the book was us going off to talk to a doctor who treats people who use steroids and finding out, you know, what they can do. And they can last for your whole life, terrible side effects and after effects. And we're just learning about this now, actually, from the ballplayers, right, of what has happened to some of those guys. So anyway, this is a long story that made long, but Joe's response was so vivid and was so persistent that I realized it's something I had to really look into as a parent and as a baseball fan.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, Joe could not become the commissioner soon enough.
And that would be fine with Joe.
Yeah. Well, you have my backing, Joe. That means nothing, but you have
it. You got his vote, yeah.
So you mentioned that you spoke to doctors, and as you lay out in this beautiful book, you took this basically this 2-year coast-to-coast trip. Doctors, retired all-stars, active players, major leaguers, minor league parks, Yankee Stadium, Fenway Park. It's quite a journey of a father and a son.
Well, you know, I'm a freelance writer. I've been a writer for 25 years, and I've done many magazine stories about lots of things, and some of them were baseball stories. So I've been in the clubhouse at Safeco Field, you know, and I got invited. I had field access for the 2001 All-Star Game in Seattle, and saw all these guys and interviewed them. So I had a journalist's sense of, well, I'll go out and get some answers. Well, it'll be easy, you know. I'll interview some people and find out about it. And quickly learn that baseball just stonewalled the whole thing. Nobody would talk to me, you know, as a journalist. I even kind of weaseled my way back into Safeco Field in Seattle on a pretext of sorts to write about the Mariners. And I went to Dave Niehaus, who was the Mariners broadcaster. Terrific guy, just a wonderful broadcaster and really nice guy who I'd interviewed many times before. And after just kind of saying, oh, you know, some bit general baseball questions, I dropped this bomb on him. You know, so what do you think about what's happening with the steroid scandal? And this was 6 months after the Mitchell report. You know, you think baseball's going to address it anymore? And he just like turned white and started stammering. This is the most eloquent guy in the Pacific Northwest. And he kind of said, I don't know. What about Clemens? You're going to put him in the Hall of Fame? Of course you are. What about Bonds, you know? And he said, I've been around the clubhouse for 35 years now, and I swear I never heard a word about this, and nobody talked to me about it, but you know something's going on just looking at these guys. And I was persistent. I kept asking him more stuff, and I got excited. And finally, he just said, I don't want to talk about steroids. You know, I don't want to talk about steroids, and I couldn't blame him. Nobody did.
Right.
And I say in the book, you know, it's the most amazing sports scandal in history. Everybody was doing it. Nobody knew a thing about it. You talk to any ball player. I didn't know anything about it. Nobody talked to me about it. You know, I suspect some guys were doing it, but oh, come on. My 8-year-old kid
right.
said knows that McGuire and Sosa and Bonds, you know, were unnaturally juiced. So anyway, going out as a journalist got me nowhere. And even Joe started writing letters to people like his favorite player, Manny Ramirez, who wasn't named, by the way, for a good year and a half into this. And to the commissioner, never got an answer. So the second half of the book, really, I decided to go out as a parent instead of a journalist. I started taking him with me. I asked for, and we got an interview with Scott Brosius, the great Yankee third baseman, who coincidentally lives in our town in Oregon and is a baseball coach, and asked him, will you talk to me and my son about the steroid situation? And he said, yeah, which was really sticking his neck out, you know. And we sat in the clubhouse of the baseball stadium at the college where he coaches, and he was right there with me and Joe and said to Joe, you know, if you idolize someone you don't know personally, you're bound to be let down. But also with this whole thing, how does it affect you for your whole life? And are we going to forgive these guys who have fallen in our estimation as we hope we'll be forgiven if we screw up in our lives? But he also said I was stunned by how pervasive it was. Even, you know, he said, of course, I knew some guys through the years were doing it and you see stuff. But he said, I couldn't believe middle relievers were doing it. Middle infielders were doing it, you know. Guys who were fast, their game wasn't power. Everybody was doing it. And so that was a terrific thing. And then, we talked to doctors who treat steroids people. We talked to a guy whose little brother committed suicide, who was a high school baseball pitcher in Texas. Did a course of steroids. His parents never knew it till they found him hung in his bedroom in a I'm sorry note on his desk. And he was coming off a steroids regime. And one of the side effects is a terrible depression. And it killed this poor kid. You know, he wanted to become the biggest, fastest pitcher on his team. And he did. He got bigger. And his game improved. But, you know, they don't tell you about the other stuff that happens. So all of this became much more than, I'm going to take my kid to a few ball games, you know, and talk about Ty Cobb, which is originally what I thought would happen that year, you know, is we'd just be baseball fans. But this was put in our lap in such a way and not dealt with in such a way. And even the players named, just, you know, the whole thing of baseball was denial, blanket denial. Didn't happen. I don't know how my name got associated with this. Yes, my name is on 15 Federal Express receipts of receiving human growth hormone, but I never used it. All this crap, you know, the tests were wrong. And you know, you understand as an adult, there's a culture of the game, right? And there's all this pressure to succeed, and there's no real... consequences that you're going to get from the hires up. That's maybe fine. I'm still on the fence about that. But the second part of it, after it happened, nobody came out and said to my kid or your kid, anybody's kid, this is really bad. That was stupid. That was the dumbest thing I ever did. This stuff is really dangerous. I wouldn't do it again in a minute, you know? And that was just baseball's whole response. So anyway, that became something we had to really talk about and deal with. And that became part of our baseball journey, was finding out the real answers to Joe's questions and going off and finding good stuff about baseball. You know, we went to where the fields in Idaho where Walter Johnson got his start, which was just, you know, it was just kind of cool. It was this little town, and I used the whole trip really to talk about Walter Johnson was like the greatest sportsman ever. You know, you read books about him, and, you know, Calvin Coolidge was the president, I think, and they were like tripping over themselves to tell Walter Johnson how much they loved him as a sportsman and a player. You know, Will Rogers wrote when Walter finally got to the World Series, you know, there is no finer man than Walter Johnson, and it wasn't fluff. Right. He really was a hell of a guy,
right.
You know. And so anyway, I took Joe to the fields where Walter Johnson got his start, and we walked into the local historical society, and unbeknownst to me, there's a whole case of Walter Johnson's glove and his bat and his jersey, you know, and pictures of him and incredibly rare baseball cards from 1912, and they said, "Hey Joe, you want to hold Walter Johnson's glove?" Sure. So they open the case and pull it out, and this great big hunk of leather, you know, is stiffer than the cow that it came off of, is on his hand. And it was just cool. And we came here to New York, and we went to games, and we went to Yankee Stadium and to Fenway, but we also went to see Jackie Robinson's grave, you know, and I felt that was a necessary part of this journey we were on to reconnect with baseball and what I felt was important about baseball, and not just let it slide past like baseball wanted us to, you know. The fans were still going to the games, and the games were still going on, and the baseball is still baseball. But the response to the steroid scandal, it just never materialized from baseball itself. So we responded to it in our own way.
And when you pick these amazing spots, Jackie Robinson's grave, the fields where Walter Johnson started. Did you select those? Did you and Joe talk about it?
I pretty much did. And you know, I have to say, it's kind of arbitrary. I say in the book, you know, why did I do this? I wouldn't go to Steve Carlton's hometown. I wouldn't go to Don Drysdale's high school field. But for some reason, that Walter Johnson thing really rang true with me. And it was also like a 10-hour drive from where we live, so it felt like a pilgrimage, you know. It was the middle of nowhere, man. It was really a tiny town in Idaho. And on the way there, 5 miles outside of town, we passed Harmon Killebrew Field, you know, where Harmon Killebrew grew up. And then you put these dots together, and you're like, you know, darn it, Harmon Killebrew died last summer, and he's not in the top 10 of home run hitters anymore. He's been surpassed by all these guys, you know? And so, you know, McGuire and A-Rod and Sosa are all ahead of Harmon Killebrew, and it's just a shame in my book as a baseball fan. You know, I wish there was a way we could have a list where Harmon Killebrew is still on it.
Right.
You know? So the kid who killed himself in Texas, a great pity and a shame. Well, he was 5 miles away from where A-Rod's playing in Texas Stadium, just got the biggest contract in the history of sports to play ball. Eric Gagne is in L.A. having the greatest year of a reliever ever, and it turns out that Eric Gagne was one of the biggest juicers of all. Unbelievable jump in numbers and performance. So you got a 16-year-old kid in Texas who wants to be the star of his team, and you got to compare him alongside those guys, don't you?
Yeah.
You know? And so these are the things that hadn't been talked about much.
Now, I believe, I don't remember his name, but I believe the father of the young boy who committed suicide, I think he's really gone to the forefront of really pushing this issue.
Yeah, actually his father and his brother both. The kid's name was Taylor Hooten, and the Taylor Hooten Foundation was started by his father, Don Hooten, and his brother, Don Hooten. And in fact, Major League Baseball funded them in a big, dramatic way. And they're going around the country now doing steroids talks and stuff. So some good is coming out of that.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And a lot of where this came from, a lot of this never would have been known, frankly, if it were not for the Mitchell Report.
Yeah.
And if you could just talk about that and about something that you have, which is About as good as it gets.
It's as good as it gets. Well, yeah, I mean, so the Mitchell Report was commissioned by Major League Baseball to see, really, is there a drug problem in our game? And Senator Mitchell, you know, interviewed and his lawyers, team of lawyers, and came out with the Mitchell Report. And it's kind of telling that there's only one ball player would actually talk to him, Frank Thomas. And everybody else who was asked to appear declined. And so it was all kind of cobbled together. Fortunately for the Mets and the Yankees trainer, right, were themselves in legal trouble, and so they kind of had to talk to Mitchell, and they had lots of evidence. Well, when you write a baseball book that talks about the Mitchell Report, somehow somebody gets a copy into Senator George Mitchell's hands, and one day in the mail, you open up the mail, and you get an autographed copy of the Mitchell Report to Jim and Joe Gullo from George Mitchell. The great artifact of our times here, the whole Mitchell Report signed. So one day you may see this on eBay. I expect it to fetch quite a nice figure. You know, there's plenty of outrage about this, and you hear it from me, and I still have it, but the book isn't just about me kind of spouting about steroids and that. It really became just a framework for going on a baseball trip with my kid, you know, and how much, not only how much we did together to do that, but I remembered all of these old baseball experiences that I've had through my life and realized how much important it was to me, you know, that all these, you know, I've been playing baseball since I was a little kid, and some really pivotal moments in my life took place around baseball. Just as a casual fan and player, you know. There's a chapter in here about playing a softball game with my father I guess it was in the 70s, yeah, the mid-70s. And I was like a 15-year-old kid, and I got, I was in the outfield against his team, and he hit the longest fly ball ever off of his bat, and I tracked it down. I stole a homer from my dad. And he never forgot it. But that was the last time we played ball together. You know, he died unexpectedly a couple of years later. And I realized, yeah, that was really important to me. And 2 months before Joe was born, we went on a Sunday morning. We got up early with our neighbors. We went up to a hillside in Seattle with a couple folding chairs and sat down and watched him blow up the kingdom. You know, that concrete monster, and the smoke and the dense cloud of it came rushing up the hill towards us, and we got the heck out of there. As my wife, you know, who's 7 months pregnant, and on the day Joe was born, a 19-year-old shortstop for the Mariners, maybe he wasn't 19, but he's around then, he hit his 19th home run in the middle of June, and it was Alex Rodriguez. You know, and the Mariners creamed the White Sox or something and had one of their best seasons ever. So all of these things were wrapped up in my baseball life. And it kind of made me mad as a parent that baseball was getting besmirched, as it were, you know, by this scandal. And I wanted to make sure my kid knew that there was more to it than that.
Absolutely. You did a beautiful job.
Yeah, thanks.
And before we take some questions, I'm going to throw one name out who's in your book, who a lot of people here and listening on the podcast probably have never heard of this person, but if you could just talk about him. His name is Dirk Hayhurst.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, Dirk Hayhurst, who many of your listeners will know as a writer more than anything, he's written two terrific books about baseball. He was a minor league pitcher when I met him in Portland. He was AAA, trying to make it to the Padres, and he was the only guy, the only player who would talk to me honestly about steroids in the game. And he said, you know, I'm not going to tell you names, and I'm not going to go into that, but yeah, I, you know, guys use it, and all of us have to make a decision of whether we're going to do it or not. And he said, I wouldn't do it, I'm not going to do it, and I believed him. And I don't believe he ever did use them. But he said, you know, I knew one guy who started taking steroids, and like 2 days after the first shot, his lift went up 80 pounds in the weight room. An immediate effect. And it was just clear that this stuff was boosting these guys. And it was also clear that every one of them had to face down the decision of whether to use it or not. And so Dirk and I became kind of friendly. We met several times that season in Portland. And then one of the great ironies of the book, he gets called up by the Padres at the end of the 08 season, and he's struggling to make it. He's not doing very well. And in a game in September, he comes in to face the Dodgers in a key situation, and Manny just crushes the ball off of him, just takes him out of the park. And Hayhurst gets he gets released at the end of the season. And as it turns out, you know, we didn't know it then, but Manny was probably one of the biggest users of all. You know, he's the only guy who's been suspended twice for violating the drug agreement. And that's what it was like. So you have this kid, Hayhurst, who's struggling to make a major league salary and make it after 7 or 8 years of struggling in the minors. And the other guys are shooting past him and making the rosters. So anyway, Dirk, though, the next season, 09, he went to spring training with the Blue Jays and made the Blue Jays roster and pitched with them for much of the season. And we finally caught up with him mid-season in Seattle with the Blue Jays. He got us terrific tickets, and Joe and I went to the games. And then, yeah, and I felt it was meaningful. He was the only ball player in a major league uniform then who sat down with me and looked my little boy in the eye and said, "I wouldn't take steroids and you shouldn't either. It's cheating and it's bad for you, and you shouldn't do something like that to try to make a few more bucks and it, you know, in your career, whatever it is." And I thought that was terrific. That's really all I wanted, you know. I wanted some baseball player to sit down and tell my kid, "This is wrong," you know? And it was that hard to get that. And of course, I didn't go out and interview or try to talk to 1,000 baseball players. I tried to get through to Jamie Moyer at one point. You know, I had a connection with him through some professional colleagues, and I wrote to him and asked, you know, "Will you sit down with me and my kid and talk about what's going on in the game?" And he declined, and I asked again, and I got a note back, you know, "Mr. Moyer respectfully denies your request for an interview," and you know, that's his business, that's fine, but still, you'd think there'd be one guy in Major League Baseball, whether it was a Moyer or a Jeter or anybody, who would come out and say, "Hey, wow, this is terrible, this is not going to happen again, you know, a Pujols, I don't care what happens over on that team, but in my clubhouse this ain't going to happen anymore, because this is wrong and it's a blight on our game." And nobody did that. They all agreed to the kind of code of sweep it under the carpet and it'll go away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Any questions from
our distinguished panel of experts?
I think the story that you just told, Jim, about was it being Dirk?
Dirk.
I think, from what I've read, that seemed to be one of the hugest quandaries that a lot of the players, marginal players or whoever, saying that, you know, "I don't believe in this, I don't want to do this," but so many of these guys felt like, "I can't compete," whether it's for the bucks, like you're talking about, making the team, and feeling like, you know, "I have to do this in order to be able to stay at least on an even playing field," which must be a terrible situation, you know, internal fight to be in. You don't want to do something that's illegal. It's terrible. Yet everybody around you is doing it.
Yeah, and they're shooting past you.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a story in this week's Sports Illustrated about four guys on a minor league staff in the late 90s. And one of them made it because in the offseason he was the one who decided to juice, put on 30 pounds of muscle and 15 miles an hour on his fastball, and how that's affected all of their lives ever since. And that's true. You know, Corey, if you're in any profession and the guy next to you at the next desk is embezzling money and everybody around him is doing it and they're getting promoted, are you going to make that decision? You know, it's a quandary, but we have to fall back on some kind of values. But also the game itself has to provide some kind of values there. and it didn't. One of the things Dirk told me that I didn't put in the book, because he asked me not to actually, was he said, you know what, the coaches never told us don't do the drugs. They said don't get caught. And that was their marching orders, right?
It's pro sports.
Yeah, it's pro sports. Yeah, it takes the shine off it a little bit, you know. And then, of course, it comes back again to Joe, you know. And Joe saying one day in the tent in the backyard, you know, what if a kid on Little League did it, took drugs? He'd suddenly pick up the ball and gun it 100 miles an hour and break your hand off, you know. And what would happen to that kid? You know, he'd be kicked out of Little League, wouldn't he? And so I want to apply the same standard to my kid. You know, you're not going to take drugs to, of course, it's silly, but to play better Little League, but you're not going to do it to play better high school ball or make the high school team or the college team. And so I think all of us kind of agree on that, don't we? If we had a kid with the talent to do it, would we say, you know, you better go take the shot this spring training so that I can see you on the Mets roster next year? I can't imagine a lot of parents going there. And then, doubly so, can you imagine you just signed Alex Rodriguez to a $250 million contract? He's the biggest thing in the game, and he's going off to his cousin in the Dominican Republic buying street drugs and taking them to enhance himself. How in the world can the trainers and the doctors and the owners and the managers allow that? That's insane, you know, that's where our heroes and our athletes eventually end up, you know, the path that they went down at that time. And all of this could be, you know, just kind of a nice nostalgia or trivia thing. But we still haven't seen really a definitive stand from anybody in the game, other than, you know, there's drug testing now and there's suspensions. But I don't think we've seen a real culture change in baseball.
Do you believe players are still taking either steroids or similar type of performance-enhancing drugs?
I think steroids would be pretty hard to get away with right now, given testing. I think that there are other drugs that are probably being used. I think human growth hormone is still very difficult to detect. And again, it's not Advil. It's stuff that makes your kidneys and your heart and your liver grow as much as it makes your muscles grow. It's nasty stuff.
Or your tumors.
Yeah, or your tumors, exactly.
There's no way to distinguish.
Yeah, right. So, you know, they're playing with fire to make that. So, I like to think baseball's cleaned up some. I don't know if it is or not. You know, why does Manny Ramirez get a job anymore? Manny Ramirez, of course, he's a great hitter, or he was. But he's walked out on two teams in the last 3 years, if nothing else. You know? I mean, last year, he started the season with the Jays, or with the Devil Rays, and he said all the right things. I'm going to help this team get back. I'm going to, you know, do everything. Within a month, when he failed the test, he didn't even address the team. He faxed in his resignation and was gone. So why would you give him another chance this year? I don't know. Maybe he'll become an incredible beacon of righteousness.
I think that if Charles Manson could go 18-2, you'd have people saying, yeah, but, you know, he's really not such a bad guy.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You know, we're going to keep a close eye on him between starts.
Yeah. Yeah. And to answer your question, you know, when you look at what Manny did when he first went to the Dodgers, you know, hitting 45 home runs in 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, it's for the immediate gratification, understanding that he might be gone, he'll juice and something will happen, but you know, certain organizations are willing to deal with that.
Yeah.
And others are saying, don't touch him with a 10-foot pole.
Well, you know, let's compare him to Josh Hamilton. You know, Josh Hamilton, we all know, has a drinking problem and has had drug problems in the past, and it's acknowledged and it's cool. You know, he gets counseling. The ball club has a guy who follows him around and is kind of his, you know, his mentor and keeps an eye on him. And so they're acknowledging that Josh Hamilton has this substance abuse problem, and they're dealing with it in a very straightforward way. They're not saying, oh, no, you know, Josh never did that. That didn't happen. He, you know, he might have been seen at a bar, but he didn't drink. You know, that was that vodka really wasn't vodka, it was water. All that stuff that, you know, I'm comparing to steroid use is how they dealt with it. So, you know, why not? That's the other thing. I kind of have this squeamish feeling as a grown-up now. I'm 55 years old, you know. Do I really want these guys who I'm rooting for and following to be taking these nasty drugs so they can perform better for my entertainment? I don't want to go there, you know. So why aren't these guys getting counseling and testing and, you know, making sure that they're okay, other than, you know, besides a suspension?
Well, I got a question for you, though.
Yeah.
What's your take on amphetamine use back when the heroes were using it?
Yeah, sure. It's a very good question.
Dangerous drug also.
If I can back that up, it brings back the drug trials in Pittsburgh and how we had our wonderful first baseman, the Mets, and all those guys, and Rock Rains with a towel over his head and a Coke on the bench.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and those guys...
They always just, you know, hit her in the ass.
But I mean, it's a theme that just keeps continually going through baseball. And what I think is amazing, one is just the stand that you're making here, I think, is the essence of the game.
Yeah.
The game is a healing game.
Uh-huh.
This is anti-healing with the drugs, whether it's steroids, whether it's coke, whether it was alcohol.
Right.
Back in the day. I mean, it's always been part of this game.
Yeah, you know. Ball 4 is one of my favorite books ever. I read it as a kid, and I've reread it several times. And I even, when I met Dirk Havers the first time in Portland, I bought him a copy of Ball 4 because I knew he was a writer. Anyway, you know, Greeny use, amphetamine use was rampant then.
That guy, what's his name? I was told that he was given red juice by Millie Mays.
Red juice, yeah.
They were supplied. They were in the
drink. This will make you go quick, kid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember watching Willie Mays in the Mets, making a basket catch. I was a kid in the stand.
Uh-huh.
Who knew that he was giving John Wilner?
From
the other end of the spectrum, too, how about Tommy John surgery? I mean, with regard to comparing people to way back, I mean, how about that? I mean, the whole thing is screwed up. It's not only about the steroid, ugly, nasty thing. Even just the culture of cheating in baseball,
yeah,
the selling of a strike and the sliding and the not checking your swing and the catching of the ball being interfered, the argument. You know, I mean,
well, all right, the shoe polish on the ball, right? I think it's stuff that, though, as a community of baseball fans, we vote on it. We say, yeah, we'll accept that. We'll accept brushbacks. You know, we'll accept that lame excuse. No, I wasn't trying to hit him. I was just brushing back. And in terms of amphetamine use, everyone was using it, but, you know, the records weren't being shattered.
Right.
And so that's the kind of the line I draw. You know, that nobody was hitting 65 home runs on greens.
In fact, they were getting sicker, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it.
But they were lasting. Those guys who beat those records lasted longer than anybody else. Once again, Hank Aaron. I don't know.
Yeah, but if you go way back to the turn of the century, the dead ball era, those guys had they had nothing. Like, they busted their knees, they played the whole season.
Yeah.
And they're still making, you know, so it's
all. Yeah, you know, you remember Jeff Nelson, the great reliever, played for the Yankees and the Mariners. It's in the book a little bit. I did talk to him. He was done with his career and was in the Mariners broadcast booth. And I asked him the same thing about the steroids, and he was forthcoming about it. But he said, you know, why should we do anything about it as players? Salaries are going up, fans are coming to the ballpark. Everyone wants to see the long ball. He gave me the same standard line. You know, of course, I didn't use them, and I didn't know who was using them, and I didn't care because I still had to get the guys out. But
Viagra.
Yeah, yeah. But he said, you know, who knows what Babe Ruth and Hank Aaron were taking? And I said, yeah, they were taking hot dogs. Babe Ruth was eating a lot of hot dogs, and so you know, I don't buy it. Steroids clearly changed the playing field. they were hitting 600 foot home runs, you know, and so, you know, as a community of fans and people who kind of oversee the game, let's say, I think you've got to make a stand against it.
I have a question for you. Sure. You know, just your observation of baseball around that time, was there like a seminal moment, like watching a game, where you kind of had like look into the television set a little bit more, and this guy is like an alien. There's something wrong with that one. Was there a moment?
A guy.
I'm kind of thinking for me, it was almost Eric Gagne.
Oh, really?
Like I was watching him pitch game after game after game. Like, how is this guy doing?
Yeah, yeah, it was a machine.
I don't think I was really aware of steroids at the time.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't so much that, but for me, the biggest moment, and it's in the book, is one day Joe comes to me, and he goes, "Dad, I got to tell you something. Look at my glove. Right? We just got him a new glove a couple of months earlier. It's a freaking Eric Gagne autograph model." It's like, Jesus, we spent money for an Eric Gagne autograph model, you know, and it just made me mad that he made this endorsement money off of us. So as part of the book, I took that glove around, and I had people sign it, you know, and made it our own autograph model to just counteract that bad juju or whatever.
Anybody else? Well, I would just like to, we can certainly mingle and enjoy the Yankee Tampa Bay game on TV in the clubhouse. Who knows what those guys are on? I'll keep my cynical views to myself.
Which ones?
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of them. But I just would like to close, and I hope I don't embarrass Jim by doing this. But once again, the book is called Trading Manny: How a Father and Son Learned to Love Baseball Again, by Jim Bulo, published by DiCapo. And as Jim said, this was really the framework to just take a baseball trip with his son. And that's really the heart of baseball, no matter what has happened or what will happen. Mm-hmm. And I just would like to close by with an email that I received.
Okay.
I have not told Jim about this, and it really touched me. And I'm going to give this to you. I will not mention the woman's name who sent this, because I don't know if she wants this public or not, but... For those of you who are listening on the podcast, the clubhouse is located in Greenwich Village, otherwise known as Freak Show Central. And when the door swings open, and nobody knows who's going to walk in. And every day is interesting, let me put it that way. But when I get an email like this, it makes it all worthwhile. And I know what it... I don't... Actually, I shouldn't say I know. My wife is a writer. I know we have some other writers here. You're a great writer. I can imagine what it takes to do a book, and the effort to write it and get it published, and then what you have to do after it's published. And I know how difficult that is, so I appreciate all the authors who come here. And this woman said a lot of this better than I ever could, so I'd just like to read this email that I received on Saturday night at 11:43 p.m. Hmm. I know this email is to RSVP, and if I didn't live in San Diego, my son and I would be the first in line. I would love the opportunity to meet the author and let him know how much his story touched me and provided me with helpful insight for those challenging times a parent is faced with in raising a son. But this email is to tell you how much I appreciate your efforts. I read about your shop through a story online about top 10 baseball-themed must-sees. I was so impressed with your site that I bookmarked it and thought, as a single mother raising a 7-year-old boy, I would one day soon purchase one of your amazingly unique products and signed up for your mailing list. I'm grateful for your emails, and this one in particular, the spotlight on this book. I was so touched by the synopsis of the story, I bought and read it today. Now please note, I am not a sports fan on any level. My introduction to baseball was when I was 9, and saw the movie The Bad News Bears. But I find myself drawn to stories about baseball mostly through movies: A Perfect Game, Chasing 3000, Field of Dreams, Pride of the Yankees, all unbelievable messages of courage and faith, and maybe that's what the game is all about for most fans. But I'm getting off base here, no pun intended. Thank you is what I wanted to convey. It's obvious you have a real passion for the game and your business. So strong it's able to touch those from afar. Thank you again. So this woman said better than I ever could.
Wow, terrific.
And we'll let her close it out. So thank you very much, Jim.
Thanks a lot, Jay. That's great.
Thank you.